is the fulfillment of a 10-year plan of mine. Jim O'Dea, who is our speaker this afternoon, has been a friend of mine for ever since we were in graduate school together 10 years ago in Vermont. And one evening, at the other side, which was the campus dive, we were having a long philosophical discussion about our roots and where we came from. And I had an opportunity to tell Jim a little bit about my Mormon roots and Mormon culture. And he was fascinated and said, "Someday I want to come to Salt Lake and have a chance to find out more about you and about your community." And as we have kept in touch over the years, I've continually said, "I'm going to get you to Salt Lake someday." So when the opportunity came several months ago, as we were identifying people who would be could make a great contribution to the Sunstone Symposium, it finally hit me, this is my chance to finally get Jim out to Salt Lake and to have an opportunity to share with so many of you the very truly great individual that has been a friend of mine for a very long time. First of all, I want to give you a little bit of biographical information so you understand sort of who he is, but then I'm going to tell you a little bit about some of my personal experiences with him and some of my personal reflections to give you a sense of who I think he is. Jim O'Dea was born in Ireland at the age of 11, moved to England with his family, and was educated at the Haberdashers Asks Hatcham Grammar School for Boys. After finishing his education at the university in England, he moved to Italy and then later to Turkey, where he taught at a boarding school for 5 years and was an assistant principal. That was the place that he met his wonderful wife, Kathleen. They survived a coup d'etat in Turkey, and that probably raised in him Jim has an undying interest in peace, in issues of human rights, in reconciliation of conflict, and having lived through that firsthand, I'm sure that that experience had a great impact on him, not to mention his own natural conflicts as an Irishman growing up in England. After their experiences in Turkey, Jim and Kathleen moved to Vermont, which is where I met them, at the School for International Training in Brattleboro, Vermont, where we were in a very intensive, almost used to refer to it as a year of therapy the program in intercultural management, which was a graduate program, very non-traditional graduate program that focused on international human studies. After their after our program in Vermont, Jim and Kathleen moved to the Middle East, where he worked for the World Council of Churches. Originally, they went to Beirut, where they organized ecumenical travel for the World Council of Churches. Unfortunately, they got caught in the Civil War. They originally went during a time of a ceasefire that didn't hold, and they were there during the invasion of Lebanon by Israel. Later, as things in Beirut completely broke down, they were forced to leave Beirut, but later they returned to the Middle East and worked in Cyprus and Jerusalem, continuing for the World Council of Churches. He later moved back to Turkey, worked with the Suryani, which is a small Christian community working in rural development in rural Turkey. Finally, they made the decision as they were having children that it was time to return to the United States, and Jim accepted the position, a position with Amnesty International, the international organization dedicated to the protection of human rights. For the last, about 7 years now? Six and a half years, Jim has served as the Washington director for Amnesty International. As such, he's in charge of government relations. He works with the White House, with the State Department, with Congress, with all of the embassy community in trying to articulate the deep problems that face us as a world in the area of human rights and trying to be an advocate for those who have no voice. Today he's not speaking on behalf of Amnesty, he's speaking as an individual. And as I was just visiting with him a few minutes ago, he was excited about the opportunity to address this important topic in a way as an official spokesman for Amnesty. He's not able to talk about the spiritual side of human rights very often, but was pleased with this opportunity to talk about what our responsibility as Christians is towards human rights. On the more personal side, as I was looking forward to catching up with Jim again, I went back to my journal. And on November 3rd, 1981, I wrote, "Watch for the name of Jim O'Dea. Someday he's going to be somebody. He has a very strong sense of who he is and what his future is. He's one of those who's going to make a difference in this world. As I have known Jim for the last 10 years and had an opportunity to learn from him and to share in many varied experiences, I want you to understand the kind of committed person that he is, and a person who is full of light. He's equally comfortable and equally open and generous with the most common person, with the homeless, with the Ted Koppels, with the Joan Baezes. He travels in very glorified circles that most of us only read about in the newspaper. I remember turning on the news not too long ago and seeing him being interviewed by Dan Rather on CBS Evening News. And yet he is, on a personal level, not caught up in the glory, but has dedicated his life to making a difference. I think he has a great deal to teach us. And I now, with great pleasure, introduce to you my friend, Jim O'Dea.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Kathy, for that introduction, which, as you would expect, is full of love. And it is really a pleasure to speak to you today. I want to thank Cindy Dahl, too, for arranging this for me and for the opportunity to speak to such a fascinating group of people. The time I have already spent listening and watching and observing you has been a very rich one. The topic of human rights and spirituality is one that covers a lot. Obviously, we will not encompass the whole subject in 40 minutes, 45 minutes. Perhaps we can at least paint the edges of this vast subject. It is one that leads us to the depths of degradation. It is one that makes us look into the heart of darkness itself. And that we must do, and we must not shy away from it. But if we look down into that depth of real human pain, it is also a subject of the most exalted, of out of that pain and out of that darkness, the rising up of the human being, of the human spirit, moving and opening a space for liberation, for freedom, for identity to flower and flourish. Spirituality, of course, is greatly mixed into that descent and that ascent. And I don't think true spirituality looks the other way or is afraid to look at that struggle, at that pain. It is not afraid to look into the poisoned heart of inhumanity. But rather, the spirit goes in there. And in that poisoned place where human beings are hung and sliced and tortured, it brings transformation. And I believe it is guided with enough wit and inspiration to lead out of that place into a place of celebration. And so, in this talk today, I want to give you the image of degradation, of the poisoned place. It is real. We must face it. I also want you to see the tremendous story of exalted humanity, the great prisoners of conscience, the great lights in the prison, the great struggle of humanity. I want you to see and feel those. There are lots of those lives that have touched mine. I also want to talk a little bit about innocence. Perhaps if those who proselytize cruelty are one end of the pole, and those who exalt humanity at the other end of the pole, there is a great ocean between of humanity that gets caught up, that gets abused, that violates, and the violated and the violators themselves become victims. And finally, I want to look at the kind of paradigm that connects human rights and spirituality, that is the road that we might take. I want to begin with Iraq, because Iraq is a reference point that many of us know. It's one that we've come to hear about. Iraq, the government of Iraq, for many years now, has been a place of unremitting cruelty. There is no lie to what the Iraqis have done. And for over 10 years, an organization like Amnesty has been begging the world to listen. In June of last year, and you will remember they invaded Kuwait in August, in June, we testified before the full Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And we told them about the gouging out of children's eyes in Iraq. Young Kurdish children who were so brutalized by the regime that they even gouged out their eyes to make this a warning to their Kurdish parents not to insurrect, not to rebel. We described the chemical weapons attacks on villages. We described groups of villagers running from chemical weapons assaults, their flesh burning, being rounded up and massacred by the troops. Yes, we know about Iraq. And you should have known too. And the world should have known. And the world should have listened. And we must listen now. Because that level of brutality exists on the planet. It is happening in many places. Let us wake up to that. And so we then documented, consistent with all of the documentation of those years in Iraq, we documented the brutality of Iraq in Kuwait. And it was the same. It was the same level of brutality. And after that awful war that left so many people dead, the Kuwaitis returned not to a kinder or gentler Kuwait, but they returned to rape, to torture, and to kill. And they did this under the very noses of those who had liberated the country. And we documented that. We documented the Palestinians who had been killed and tortured and who are now being expelled from Kuwait. And what did they learn? And what was that about, that they came back to do those acts? Jack Healy, whom some of you will have heard of, is the executive director of Amnesty International, has said that the root of all of this degradation of human rights is in the concept of the lesser person. And he says, there is no lesser person on the face of the earth. There is no lesser person on the face of the earth. And how right he is. There are no lesser Sikhs, Buddhists, Baha'is, Muslims, Hindus, Jews, people with AIDS. There are no lesser people. There are no lesser Palestinians. There are no lesser Hare Krishna. And this is the lesson we must learn. That as we look out into the world, we see each other, we see the human face. We don't see the flag or the religion or the color of the eyes. We must learn to look into the heart. We must learn to look at the world filled with humanity. And human rights is relentlessly practiced. Violations are practiced against the lesser people. In Brazil, the children, the street children of Brazil, who go to the capital because they have no work, because they abandon rural life, and they move around in gangs to protect each other, and yes, they are in some ways a menace and a threat to society, have become the lesser people of Brazil. And at least one of those street children is murdered by the police, by police squads in Brazil, every day of the year. They are on the fringe. They are the erasable. They can be scratched out. Who will miss an orphaned street kid? And we know, in a sense, that the Palestinians, too, have become lesser people. And we must raise them up and say, Israelis and Palestinians, you are both Semitic people. You are mirrors of each other. It's like the Greeks and the Turks. You are the same. In many ways, you are the same passionate, deeply wonderful people. The scale is something we have got to get into our minds. We get fixated on remembering the Holocaust and the Second World War or the Cambodian genocide. There are little pockets that we remember that are in our consciousness. But the scale is vast. Look at Kashmir and the Punjab and India. India, the mother of so much spirituality. People are killing each other and disappearing. There is rape and torture on a vast scale. Look at Sri Lanka, this little once paradise island, has been convulsed with terror and disorder, and so many tens of thousands of people, of young people, have disappeared. And once the ambassador said to me, when I said, where are they? And I gave the names and I gave the lists and the lists. And he said, well, perhaps they've gone on vacation. Yes. What an answer. No, they have not gone on vacation. They've been killed in some back street, some lonely place where a young person ought not to die. And Peru. Look at the scale in Peru, convulsed on one side with the ghoulish, nightmarish terror of the Maoist Shining Path. And as if violence loves to mirror itself, the Peruvian security forces come back and they rape. As they go through an area, they rape the women. And the men they take in and they torture, or they give the bodies back to the families, or there are graves. And I don't want you to wake up every beautiful sunrise of your life to contemplate this horror. That's not what I'm asking. But I'm asking you to see it. I'm asking you to find out about it. We are now in the global village. And so we are the equivalent, we're in the equivalent posture in terms of our communication structure that we were in the 1940s. And there were a lot of people who said they didn't know. Well, find out, please. And if it's Amnesty, read our reports. Our reports are numerous, and perhaps we only document a fragment of the horror, but that's a place to begin. And let's not be passive. Let's ask our media and our politicians to go and take their cameras and take their action and take their appeals to these places. Because on every continent, people are being desecrated. Before I move to dwelling on what I call those exalted ones, I think we should stay for one moment and look at ourselves, at our backyard. There aren't prisoners of conscience here in the United States. People are not tortured in Iraq. But we do have things to be very deeply concerned about. One of them is the death penalty, U.S. style. Every year now, for the last decade, about three countries have been abolishing the death penalty. There's a global trend towards abolition. Europe has completely abolished the death penalty. And the United States is going in the other direction. It's escalating its use. And it's on a very strange list when you look at it, when you look at the practice. The United States executes retarded citizens. And I have looked at Amnesty's material around the world, and I can't find another country that says in its Supreme Court decisions, yes, we can execute the retarded. That's something to look at. And the Supreme Court also accepts, yes, the death penalty in the United States is racist. Yes, it has been applied in a racist way. The Supreme Court acknowledged that. Perhaps there are those who think that the death penalty is a ticket to political life, who think that it's a solution for the 20,000 homicides per annum. And it's so wonderful to come into a place like this, to a community like this, because America has got a lot to learn about community. And let us take on that responsibility. Let us make that our spiritual quest, to heal America, to heal all those alienated people, all those psychotic people who go murdering. That is a healing job for us to do. It isn't something to totemize. As Dick Gregory said in his wild and wonderful humor, if Jesus Christ had lived in our time, we would be walking around with electric chairs on our necks. It is something to think of. And on one more personal note before, again, as I said, go to higher planes, and it is a very personal note, I want to understand what kind of sensitivity or insensitivity we have showed, we show, in all this rah-rah victory parade stuff. Over 100,000 Iraqi military died, and we don't know how many civilians were killed. And I say war victory machismo is morally wimpish. There is nothing to celebrate. Kicked ass? Is that what we call mass destruction? We need to learn something there. We need to learn it. Well, now it is time to celebrate. To celebrate those lives that I say hold open the spaces. They are spiritual forces in our time. They are really something to celebrate. And I want to hold up Andrei Sakharov. And I want to hold up Stephen Biko. And I want to hold up Oscar Romero. I want to hold up those people who go down into the place of persecution. And they say, I will resist, and I will not relent in my conscience, and I will hold on to my beliefs. And they're not people of the past, they're people of today. But I don't know what it is that sings in their hearts when they're persecuted, when they're tortured, that makes them look ahead, that keeps the vision before them. But they truly are the salt of the earth. They truly are the keepers of the way. And perhaps we all know of Andrei Sakharov and his great struggle. He's become an icon of the human rights movement. But what of Irina Ratushinskaya? Perhaps few of us have heard of her. A poet who lived in the Gulag and learned to write and compose her poetry on a bar of soap. And she would scratch out a verse or two in this micro-writing. I don't know how she did it. And then she would wash it off on the occasion that they let her shower and wash. She washed it away, lest they read the treasonous muse. What a great spirit Ratushinskaya reflects. And many of us know of Stephen Biko and his heroic struggle and his tragic murder in prison in South Africa. But few have heard of Simon Farisani, a Lutheran pastor who fought and resisted apartheid, who was dragged into prison, who was given electric shock torture repeatedly, who had a double heart attack as a result of that electric shock. And when they finally released him, because Amnesty and others clamored so much, he came out and he fought apartheid again, and he resisted again. That unbreakable spirit, that is what I'm holding up. That is what we've got to see also. Not you or I who possess it, but we may share it. It is there on the planet and we need to celebrate it. Many of us know of Oscar Romero. What a great life, what a courageous life he lived. What noble ideals he stood for. But few, if any, perhaps none in this room, have heard of a man called Carlos Rodriguez. He wasn't a Salvadoran, actually, Carlos. He was an Argentinian. And Carlos was a simple man, as many of these people are. Great in spirit, simple in life. And Carlos was able, at certain points during his long imprisonment and frequent torture, to get scraps of paper. And on the scraps of paper, he used whatever coloring was in food, the dye from food, to make little drawings of beauty and color to send to his son. Mercifully, some of those got through the guards, some of those were destroyed, and we have them. They're so full of life and joy. A father's dream to his son. And do you know how noble Carlos was when he was on the torture rack? And he thought, this time I'm going to die. This time I'm not going to make it through. And he said, this thought came into my head. At least my son will know that his father died nobly for a noble cause. What beauty of spirit to share, to uphold, to uplift. I want to keep talking for a few more minutes about these people because these are the light in the darkness. Amnesty has an image of the candle in barbed wire, and the flame of the candle, the flame of the light of conscience, imprisoned, persecuted. This man's name is Mohammed Taher, an African, and we need to hold up those great African spirits who are struggling for human rights. We don't get enough stories of them in our papers. We don't hear enough of Africans and their struggle for human rights. Mohammed Taher was from the Sudan. And in my work for Amnesty, I was bringing Liv Ullman, a great woman who's done a lot for children's rights, to the Children's Museum in Boston. You know, he said, I have so much of a debt to Amnesty. I went to Amnesty in Los Angeles and I said, they've taken my friend An-Naeem. He's a lawyer in the Sudan and I know he's never done a violent thing in his life. Can you please see, you know, what the case is about? And indeed, Amnesty defined him as a prisoner of conscience. We set a campaign and An-Naeem was freed. And An-Naeem was a friend of Mohammed Taher, and he said to Ken Brecker, he said, you ought to go to the Sudan and meet Mohammed Taher. He's really a wonderful spiritual light. Well, Mohammed Taher at the time was preaching, his crime was to preach within the context of Islam, equality of the sexes, freedom of religion, tolerance and respect for all religious viewpoints, recognition of the state of Israel. Terrible crimes, you'll admit. And so Brecker made the trek to the Sudan and went to a remote part of the Sudan to meet with Mohammed Taher, and he said it was a very deserted, desert-like place, and there was a long line of people who were waiting to talk to this man, to get a blessing from him, to share his views, to witness his peace. And finally, when Brecker got to meet Mohammed Taher, Taher said, well, what is it in all of your life and all of your experience that has brought you to this remote corner of the world to meet me? And Brecker gave what was his answer and felt very filled by the experience of meeting Taher. And when the experience was over, with, I guess, typical American or Occidental intensity, Ken Brecker said, you know, Mr. Taher, I just know one day we're going to meet again. And he started to walk away. And Mohammed Taher called him and he said, oh, Mr. Brecker? He said, Mr. Brecker, I have one question. Do you really know? And Ken Brecker said, well, not really, but, you know, I feel it in my heart. And Taher said, oh, thank God. Thank God in heaven that you don't know, Mr. Brecker. A few months later, Mohammed Taher was executed in his 80s by his government for the things that I've told you about. And for a moment, let me talk about Mubarak Awad, the last of these people I want to uphold today. Mubarak Awad studied Gandhi, a Palestinian who studied Gandhi, who started teaching Gandhian methods of nonviolence, and was detained in Israel for this. And then, perhaps the ultimate punishment, he was expelled from his land. He was accounted, defined by Amnesty as a prisoner of conscience, but he was expelled from his land for what he had been doing. He came here and he started to teach peace and nonviolence and love and reconciliation between Israelis and Palestinians. He's now the leading force of an organization, new and interesting organization that you will see more of, called Nonviolence International. And his work is on an international scale promoting nonviolence. As I said, between these exalted exemplars of the human spirit, there are the oceans of those who get caught up, and I want to talk about those for a moment. The victims, those who don't choose to be part of the struggle. Many of the victims just get sucked into violence without being a part of the confrontation. I think of one case. Her name is Noor Jahan from Burma. Noor was 1 year old when she was imprisoned. Now, what do you think a 1 year old could do that a government would lock her up? Something to do with her diapers? something to do with her mother. When Amnesty heard about Noor, she was 29. She had lived her life in prison. She'd grown up to see the prison walls. She'd never seen a mountain. She'd never seen the sea. She'd never walked free. We raised a campaign. We even had inner city school children in Washington do a play about her, get other high school kids and so on, get active on her case. Many people are victims, as I said, because they're the wrong color, the wrong religion, the wrong ideology. People who do not choose to be involved in clashes. I think of during the Cambodian genocide, because I know and have touched with many of the people who survived that. If you spoke English, if you knew English and spoke English, you were automatically killed by the Khmer Rouge. So people have been executed on the planet for knowing and speaking English. People have been executed in China for waving a flag. Many people are grossly abused and are victims in the process of struggle for what they believe are their ethnic or religious rights. And then something happens. The hatred gets out of control and a new force enters. We see this in Yugoslavia today. When hatreds get out of control, the scale of the abuse rises exponentially. But you know, there are also victims who violate. I think of the young people who are inducted into security forces and conditioned. There's a wonderful film about this. It's called Your Neighbor's Son, The Making of a Torturer. And it has been our experience that your neighbor's son, as good and healthy and wholesome a lad as any could be, can be induced and conditioned to torture. Such people are victims. Those who violate because they've been conditioned to do so are also victims. And indeed, the people who grow up in that conditioning, who are told it's us or them, who are told if we don't get them, they will get us. That whole paranoid lie that some groups get born and educated by their teachers, by their religious leaders, by their politicians into. Those people are victims. And perhaps too, in the ocean of victims are those who fall asleep, who become paralyzed, who know that the children of Earth are being murdered and killed, but who simply cannot activate their power and their potency to rise up and to do something about it. They are victims of overconsuming. They are victims of endless hours in shopping malls. They are victims of too much TV. They are victims of the media that doesn't tell them the story. They are victims of a conventionalized religious education that teaches them certain practices but does not evoke their potential and their power to rise in defense of those who are being bludgeoned and beaten down, and the poor and terrible ones who fall asleep are victims. You know, I think of Max Weber's words, that famous book of his, which I think is called The Spirit of... this Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism. Thank you. We have become specialists without spirit. Sensualists without heart. This nullity imagines that it has attained the highest level that civilization has ever achieved. It is an image that we must study and deal with. It's central to my thinking on the relationship between spirituality and human rights. It has to do with becoming specialists. And oh, how many specialists and experts we have in so many fields. Without spirit. Sensualists. Look at all the sensuality that is promoted in our part of the world. And the aching for a deeper sensuality. But it's sensuality without heart. It hasn't gone down. The sensuality hasn't gone down and become integrated. I heard somebody talk this morning about erotic theology. The sensuality hasn't gotten into the theology. It hasn't gotten fecund. It hasn't gotten ripe. As a friend of mine, Jean Houston, has said, it hasn't gotten feisty. We need feisty theology. Our sensuality has to flow. Is the divine without sensuality? It has to be integrated in. And what I see in the world of human rights is ideology that goes off. It may be the best, the most beautiful ideology in the world. It goes off imperiously to its ultimate goal. It forgets its root. It loses its mother. It says, I am it, follow me. We are off to the perfection that you have never before experienced. Let's go, we need it, we're aching for it. We all long for the perfect world. I will take you there. And religion and ideology that goes marching off imperiously to its ultimate goal. Without bending to its mother. Without deeply reverencing its roots. Without holding low to the earth. Without feeling the earth. Somehow gets up there and clashes. And you have the intellectual titans at each other's throats. You have the lords of battlement challenging each other. Because one ideology is on its ultimate road, and it meets another ideology on its ultimate road. And it says, but I am the perfect ideology. No, but I am the perfect ideology. And they clash. And the clashing, of course, isn't abstract. The clashing is killing, is pain. Destruction of human life. And so, the spiritual connection, I believe, with human rights may have a good start in conscience. It's an old-fashioned word, conscience, isn't it? Don't hear it much in Washington these days. Oh, I'm sorry, I can't do that with my conscience. The special interests, as Congressman Owens was saying earlier, have become the conscience. Conscience is a good place for us to look. And I believe that conscience is somehow the reservoir of all the good that we perhaps inherently possess, all the good that we've been taught, all the good that's around. And it fills up in this beautiful, clear, pristine reservoir of truth and it only asks that it be tapped. It only asks that it be called upon. It only says, turn on the spigot and I'll tell you. And we say, oh, I don't want to deal with what's back there. And conscience, you know, is in these years with Amnesty has fascinated me deeply because it's transparent. Everybody can see it. What is there that exists in the world that is so pure and transparent and clear as conscience? I look to Asia, to Africa, and I see people doing things, and I say, that's an act of conscience. And the walls of nationality and religion and ideology and wealth and all the barriers that could exist don't block my view. Conscience lets me see clearly through and says, yes, you may live in a different world than I do. You may have totally different views, but I recognize your conscience. So perhaps we have a transparency, a global transparency to look at each other in if we would only release our conscience. Secondly, compassion. That heart-sourced energy which will reduce the lords of bafflement and those intellectual titans. They can't deal with compassion. And you know, compassion needs no rationale. It needs no formal power. It needs no ceremony. It needs no status. It needs, just as with conscience, someone to let it flow through. Compassion is there and it wants to move through the wall of apathy. All we are asked to do is knock out the wall of apathy and she will flow through. Conscience, compassion, and consciousness of the interconnectedness of all life on planet Earth. I've chosen never again. I did it once and I realized at the time it sounded wrong and I know why it was wrong. I swore never to use animal analogies. Pigs and dogs and toads are part of the natural order. And the things that people do that are unnatural when they kill and torture each other are part of an unnatural order. And let's not confuse the natural and the unnatural order. Let us have consciousness of the interconnectedness of all human life. We really are a global village. We've got to hone our intercultural skills if we are to survive. And you know, I believe that when we actually get to the point of delighting in other cultures, as opposed to tolerating, when we actually get to the point of seeing the beauty of the difference, tremendous energy is activated. Tremendous potency rises up in us to be able to deal with global problems and the world we live in. Conscience, compassion, consciousness of our interconnections. And finally, celebration. Perhaps celebration is the master key to understanding the relationship between human rights and spirituality. To me, the analogy is in the analogy of the root that goes down. It goes deeply down into the darkness. We cannot get obsessed with that. We cannot become obsessive. We cannot become morose about the terrible, terrible destruction that is happening on the planet. We do have to go into it. We do have to have the sight to see and to go into it and to transform it. Hopefully the grace to come out of it. But this root that drinks the nutrients of Earth herself and carries it aloft and bears fruit. That is, I think, the model of celebration. And those religions and ideologies and whatever they are, ethnocentrisms that go marching to their ultimate goal, without bowing to the mother, do not find celebration. But when we bow deeply to the mother of our being, to the source of our being, when we really treasure down that source that has given us life and light, we can rise up to dance and to dance and to celebrate each other and to live, because we've found a harmony and we found perhaps a path between heaven and hell. Thank you.
For those of you who are interested, I just want to remind you that there will be a tape available outside of Jim's address. And I think this has been a great opportunity to be spiritually fed. And I hope that each one of us will... Oh, that's right. Thank you. For those of you who'd like to continue the discussion and ask Jim further questions about perhaps some specifics of things that he thinks that we could do to make a difference, there will be a question and answer period in room 740. Thank you very much.